Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I'm so happy to have my mother, Caroline Kilborn, with us today.
Yes, thank you. I'm in Iowa, and Monica is in Texas.
That's right. So we're going to be separated for a couple of months now, since traveling back and forth isn't so easy
in this
time of COVID, which hopefully will someday be a distant memory.
Yes, very distant, I hope.
Yeah. So, Mom, what do we have in store today?
Well, we have a book that everybody should read. Even if you're not going to have to experience this situation, you should know about it. The book is, My Dad, My Dog. The author, Rebecca Warner, is the author of the two-time award-winning thriller Moral Infidelity, as well as Doubling Back to Love and He's Just a Man. She has been a newspaper columnist and a blogger for HuffPost. As healthcare surrogate for her parents, Rebecca, she navigated the caregiver and healthcare labyrinth for 14 years. Her experiences inspired her to write My Dad, My Dog. And she lives now with her husband, Jason, in Asheville with their rescue dog, Chance. And I must say this is a fantastic book. It really is.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. And hi, Caroline. Thank you for that nice introduction.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I got to tell you, Rebecca, when I didn't read the author before I read the book, and I was almost to the end before I realized this wasn't a memoir.
Yes. Interestingly, people are posting reviews and saying this was a wonderful memoir. And the publisher and I were discussing how to categorize it. He said, you're going to have to decide, is this a memoir or a fiction book? I said, well, it's fiction because my dad never actually lived with me, and I had to create this whole scenario to write the book. And so it seems to be crossing some lines there where people, but it is very realistic in some respects. Of course, I did see my dad every single day, year in and year out. And so that love and attachment I had to him was very real, and that was poured into the fiction prose. But to put him in my home for 24/7 for the purposes of the book, that required a lot of heartfelt, tearful conversations with in-home caregivers. And I just wrapped all of that into the novel.
Well,
it was an emotional ride.
Well, it was so realistic. It was so,
absolutely.
It's like, okay, I'm going to ask her, was she keeping a journal during all of this? How did she remember all these details?
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. It was just such an integral part of my life for so many years that really the journal was all of these memos and faxes to doctor's offices and facilities, and of course lots of pictures and memories, and of course a lot stayed with me and was incorporated into the book. Yes.
Now the character in the book, Rachel, who is kind of you, I'm guessing, or at least parts of you are in Rachel.
I could tell you, oh no, it's not me. But as I said, the feelings, the love, the attachment, all of those things went into the story itself. But Rachel is not only Rebecca, but there are some other people who came into formulating her as the character. And one was my big sister, who has a lot of forbearance and patience and kindness. And then some of the caregivers that I spoke with. I spoke with a number of people who'd given in-home care and just incorporated some of their wonderful attitudes into the story as well.
Now, Rachel's sister wasn't always very present and helpful, or sisters weren't very present and helpful for her. So that was when I thought this was a memoir. That was the other question I was going to ask about how your sisters felt about this story.
Well, it's true. It's kind. There's a lot in there. No, they did not have very. They had did had very little to do with that dad's actual caregiving over the years, but they did live distantly, as they did in the book. And they were loving daughters. They came to visit when they could. They loved dad very much. It was just a matter of logistics, and again, who was most available of the three daughters to provide that kind of care for dad.
Of course, the husband of the heroine in the book is very helpful too, and that makes a big difference too, doesn't it?
Oh, and that is true of my husband. He was wonderful. All of those years, the many thousands of hours that we spent apart taking care of my mother and my father over 14 years, and just how supportive he was, and how generous he was to keep dad at a very nice facility for many years, privately paid, and just a very good man. And he did support Rachel a lot in the book.
Mm-hmm. And that's very important.
It is important.
Yeah.
So many caregivers I spoke with really didn't have help. They had mm-hmm. jobs, they had children, they had demanding husbands, they didn't have money. They had it much worse than Rachel. And so just talking to those people really gave me a lot of insight into what it was really like to care for someone in the home. And they did not have the support Rachel had.
Now,
and they didn't have a dog.
Oh, now I believe that November is National Caregivers Month.
It is.
So this is a very timely book for this.
Who knew? Exactly. Yeah. I was accepted by the publisher in January, coming out this month. And what's interesting too is how it's coinciding with you talking about COVID. Caregiving is much more in the media and in just dialogue these days, because we've realized how important during this time caregivers are to people who are ill and in nursing homes. And so it's kind of all coming together. In fact, it's becoming a bit of a crisis because of so many healthcare workers becoming ill themselves. Mm-hmm. And if I may, I wanted to share that I'm on some Facebook groups that have popped up since this, and many people are taking, not many, many who can make it possible, are taking their parents and grandparents out of long-term care facilities and bringing them home because they're afraid of them catching COVID and perhaps dying from it. And they're also very worried about the isolation that their loved ones have been suffering in these facilities. They can't mm-hmm. see them in person, touch them, kiss them. For 7-8 months now, they haven't been able to make actual contact with their loved ones. So caregiving is in the home is becoming a more prevalent thing during this time too.
Well, I didn't realize that there were so many possibilities of help within some communities. I don't suppose that's true of all communities. The people that helped Rachel came into the home and helped her. I don't know, because I haven't not. My mother was in the nursing home, but I didn't know there was any help available. You know, so I'm sure a lot of people don't. How do they find out? How do they find out if there's help available?
There are organizations, government agencies, but I think that if you can touch base anywhere in your community with an organization like Memory Care, they facilitate the care of families and patients. They help patients cope, and the families. Mm-hmm. There are resources, but there are no government resources for in-home caregiving. That's an unpaid position, but health agencies and government agencies and any kind of Alzheimer's care unit can help you find someone. Now, Rachel didn't really have great resources, and she couldn't afford a lot of resources, but she did have a loving contingent of friends and family to help with Joe.
You know,
well, yeah, some of the women that helped her were really amazing. I thought, you know, that treated her dad just as if he was their dad, and that was quite touching.
You know, Caroline, if I may tell you this, that's so true of the caregivers that he had at his assisted living, and I think it was different because it was. These are people who had grown up in these mountains, and there's a very strong sense of family and caring and caregiving, taking care of family. And these wonderful caregivers in his facility treated him like that, loved him, really pampered him. And so those were very realistic characters in that book. That's why I admire them so much. What they do is a very hard job, and to do it for a family member is one thing, but to do it for strangers, that's...
And for such little pay.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
These women, right now, the average pay for a caregiver is about a CNA, Certified Nursing Assistant, is a little over $13 an hour. And I know when Dad was in the facility, it was more like $8 an hour. And when you think about someone taking care of every bodily function of a person, on top of giving them emotional support and being kind and patient, it's a remarkable people. The remarkable people who go into that profession, I admire very much.
Indeed.
And, you know, you do bring out this point in the book, too, but about home caregivers, family caregivers, it being unpaid, even though often they're saving Medicare or Medicaid a lot of money by caring for these folks in the home. And, you know, maybe they deserve some help with that.
I agree with you. And that is one thing I'm advocating for and speaking with you and every radio interview I do and going forward. I don't know if people realize that the latest numbers from AARP, the number of people who are doing in-home care, it's increased from 16.6% of the population in 2015 to 19.2% of our population in 2020. And about 53 million Americans provide care without pay to an ailing or aging loved one. And they do for it an average of 24 hours a week. Now, there's a real economic impact here because if you're a caregiver, you may have to take time off of work and you're not going to get paid. You may get fired for taking time off work. You're putting your livelihood at risk. You also end up paying a lot out of pocket to take care of someone who's living in your home, and you have no financial resources to help you with that. It's expensive. Medicine, toiletries, diapers, all of those things come into play. And also, it's something to think about, which isn't, most people wouldn't think about, but it impacts your Social Security contributions if you're not working and you have to stop working to take care of an ailing loved one. And so your check's going to be a lot smaller down the line because you haven't made as many contributions. And that's why I think that this should be a position that is really rolled into being part of the healthcare system. And actually, President-elect Biden has a plan. He realizes what a serious crisis this is in this country, and he does have a plan to, I don't think it goes far enough, but it does talk about tax credits and some kind of compensation for caregivers. And I think that it's getting the attention now that it deserves. But it's going to be a while before it gets implemented. But I truly believe that caregiving for loved ones can't be looked upon as a volunteer position any longer. I mean, the sacrifice for the caregivers is just too great to ignore. It has to become an integral part of the established healthcare practices. And that's what President-elect Biden is going to be doing. He's going to be throwing $775 billion at the problem.
Whoa.
Yes, over 10 years, because he says we're trapped in a caregiving crisis within an economic crisis within a healthcare crisis. And that's where we are in this country. And it's going to get worse before it gets better, but hopefully something will come about. He's talking about Social Security credits if you take off, if you don't have a job because you're home caring for someone, but it doesn't actually address compensation other than a $5,000 tax credit. But you know, if you're not working and you don't have an income, you don't really need that tax credit, right?
Well, maybe he's thinking a refundable one, like earned income credit.
I'm not sure about that, but that's a good thought.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, it seems like getting the credit for the amount you would have paid into Social Security if you were being paid for this is the least we could do.
The least we could do. And think about the economic impact. That it would be great for the economy because you have, let's say, 53 million people who are now getting paid, and they're paying into Social Security, taxes, FICA. They're contributing, they're buying. It's a boost for the economy, really. These are economically depressed people in many cases, and now you're giving them resources where they can add to a vibrant economy. It's another segment of the workforce. But I'm sorry. I hope I'm not getting too much into this. This is near and dear to my heart, as you can tell.
Obviously, and I totally agree.
Thank you.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Rebecca Warner, author of My Dad, My Dog. Well, let's talk about your dog.
Okay. That's a pleasurable thing to talk about.
So, obviously, you are a dog lover.
Oh, yes. And we've had a number of dogs over the years, usually two or three at a time. A lot of them, you know. You can't use rescue dogs so much anymore, even though they all were, but that's kind of worn out, you know. So all of our dogs have come from shelters or bad situations, and we fostered dogs. But Nick was a really special dog, and he did come from a very sad situation, which was described in the book. And do you remember that about
yes.
how she?
Yeah.
And that was actually just exactly. Characters were changed to protect the integrity, but
to protect the guilty.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. The circumstances, how he came into our lives, and it was just like a switch turning on for him in terms of there's a whole life outside of this. And we lived on 46 acres, riverfront, creeks, and he could just... Instead of living in an 8x8 pen, he suddenly had all the freedom in the world. It was private lane, no cars, no anything to worry about. And he was very much loved very quickly.
I bet he had fun every day, didn't he?
Oh, you know, Labs have a gift for happiness. We've had all kinds of dogs, but I've just got to say, Labs, when I talk about them smiling, their joyfulness, they just live in the moment and they live for their people. And that's the way Nick was. And he was so affectionate and the kind of dog that would come up and bury his head under your leg for love and affection and to give it. Do you all have dogs?
Not now.
I grew up with dogs.
But,
not now, but
yeah.
I did grow up with them. Yeah.
Yeah. I travel back and forth between Texas and Iowa too much to make it practical to have a dog. But when I was raising my kids, we had all kinds of dogs.
Yes. Yeah. So you know how much joy they can add to your life.
Yeah.
And it really is hard to have dogs and if you have to travel.
Yeah.
There's so much to consider
right.
when you travel. So yeah. I certainly understand that.
Yeah. One of the dog that we had through most of my kids' childhood, talk about a rescue dog. My ex found the dog. We lived out in the country in Iowa, rural Iowa, found the dog on Christmas Eve on the side of the road next to an empty box.
No.
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was, you know, not a full grown dog. It was a young dog. And it was in the snow.
In the snow.
And so he saw it. Stopped, picked it up, brought it home, and that was my kid's Christmas present.
Not exactly all fluffed up and wrapped in the red coat, but what a great
Oh, they
Christmas
loved it. They
present.
loved it. And her name was
It was.
Dozer, and she was a small dog, don't really know what kind, a mutt of some sort, long, floppy black ears, and very, very friendly, and really thought she was a person.
Well, I wonder how she came to that conclusion. Somebody must have treated her very, very well for her to feel that
But
way.
the
She must have been
funniest.
smart, too.
Yeah, and the funniest thing though was when she ran, it was like she hopped like a rabbit and her ears would flop up and it was
Oh, she was a happy
she
doggy.
was a happy doggy.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I love stories like that. What a life you gave her. How long did she live?
I'm trying to remember. I think she and we had moved, we were still out in the country, but we had moved onto a highway and I think she got hit. I think she got hit by a car. Yeah, I'm
But had a
trying.
good time in between.
Yes.
Yes. Good for you for doing that.
She was older when it happened though, because it was because of her hearing that we had noticed her hearing was starting to go. And she'd lived, we'd lived out on that highway for years and years, and she knew how to deal with it. But we didn't think that because she was older and her hearing was getting less that she wouldn't hear the cars coming. So,
How can you even anticipate that? She always handled it before, so I'm sure it was very sad for you, but look what a wonderful life you gave her all those years.
That's the saddest thing about owning a dog is you know that you're probably going to outlive them. And I've had so many friends who've lost dogs in recent years that they'd had for 10, 12 years, and it's
Yes, we've
so
said goodbye to
hard.
a number of dogs, and I must tell you, my husband's a stalwart man and very good-hearted, and I've only seen him cry a couple of times in his life. His father's funeral, his mother's funeral, but when we had to say goodbye to a dog, that's when my husband really teared up. They were their family.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's why in the book, I had to bring the family to Rachel had to bring the family together. It wasn't going to work if everybody wasn't with the program.
So in My Dad, My Dog, your dad didn't like dogs. And so when he came to live with Rachel, he didn't want to have the dog near him. And this was kind of heartbreaking for Rachel and also for Nick, for the dog. Now, how was your real dad and your real dog? Did they have some issues like this?
Dad was not afraid of Nick, but I think part of that was putting on a certain facade to not seem afraid, but he wasn't affectionate with him. The dog could be around him and he was fine, but always a little cautious. He just didn't have a real affection for him. So I always thought that Dad was just tolerating the dog because he was at our home. But I had to make it more than that when I moved in. And truly, Dad was a mailman who did get bitten by dogs. So they weren't his favorite thing. He was never unkind, but we didn't have a lot of dogs growing up.
It makes a difference, I think. And obviously there are dog people and there are not dog people.
Yes, but we had to make them grow to love each other in this book, and that was it was easy enough to do because both of them were lovable. They just hadn't spent enough time together. I think.
The thing about this book, My Dad, My Dog, is that not a lot really is happening in it. There's no real, there's not a lot of drama, there's not a lot of conflict, and yet it really drew me in and made me want to see how it isn't even just how it turned out, because I kind of knew what would happen in the end, but more just the daily details were so charming. The day-to-day was so charming.
That is so nice of you to say thank you because the first book I wrote, Moral Infidelity, was a thriller. And it was fast paced, and it was a totally different kind of book. And so many people who reviewed it said couldn't stop turning the pages, real thriller, page turner. And My Dad, My Dog was a totally different tone. You're right. And I kind of worried about that because for some people it might seem slow. But for you're telling me that you wanted to keep reading because you liked the day-to-day life within that household, that means a great deal to me. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah, that's true. Didn't it start with a little bit of food that that the dog was able to work with your cat?
They both loved food. They both had a love of food. And yes, I think food was one of the things that brought them together, especially that incident with the grilled cheese sandwiches when Dad got to appreciate Nick a little more with, some humor and realizing that he was just as much of a food hound as Dad was. So yes, that is one way. And also, there were therapy sessions where they were able to spend time together. You'll recall that. And just slowly, they had to get to that point themselves. And Rachel did what she could to facilitate it, but they had to really come to know and love each other and communicate in their own way. And that's the wonderful things with dogs and humans and or any pet, but I think more dogs than cats. I think that when there's love, there's a give and take of emotional support, and that's what I wanted to show as well, the starting of the emotional support. And then the physical comfort and the health benefits. We know about the health benefits that come from having a pet, and actually it goes in both directions in a relationship. So, and there's a kind of communication that happens that because Joe couldn't communicate that well, but he and Nick understood each other. So that was how I wanted to build that relationship. And do you think it came through?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Oh,
Yeah, because
thank you.
oh yes, yeah.
I
Because
appreciate that very much. Thanks.
when your dad was in his last days, the dog, of course, was having trouble getting around and
Right.
everything, but he was right there. He was right there beside your dad, and yeah.
Yes. And even if you can't see it or hear it or feel it, you know it when that kind of loving presence is there.
That's right. I always got annoyed. I lived in the country for a while, and I always got annoyed when people would drop their dog off and not come back. That always, I had one time a dog, people dropped him off by the mailbox. And he sat there, and I made sure that he had food and water, but he sat there for 3 days waiting for his people to come back. So
Oh.
finally, I got him because I had been feeding him. I got him to come. I couldn't take care of him because my husband's in the hospital, and I just couldn't manage it. But he, I took him to the vet, and and I checked later, and somebody had adopted him.
Oh, that
But
was really nice of you.
it just annoyed me so much when people do things like that,
Well, we saw
So.
it a lot where we lived. There was a road leading up to our lane, and it just seemed like a drop-off point for dogs. And one day, my husband and I were leaving, and we were going away overnight, and there was this dog at the end of our lane. It was a Rottweiler. That's Rocky the Rottweiler. Yes. And I said, "Well, I hope he doesn't find his way to our house."
And lo and behold,
We came home and there was Rocky sitting there like he belonged at that home. And he wasn't going to leave. And it was interesting because Rottweilers can be intimidating, just their looks.
absolutely.
And I thought, okay, let me get this, of course, like you did. This dog needs food and water. As I'm trying to give it food and water, he keeps moving away from the food and water and keeps coming towards me. And I realized all he wanted was affection. And so he just was the most fabulous dog. And somebody, this surprised me, we trained him very well. We'd had lots of dogs, and you would tell them to stay, and they never stayed. And Rocky, one day I was going down the stairs and I just was going to check something out. I said, "Stay." And I went on down the stairs and I was expecting him to trot right behind me like all dogs did. And I turned around and he was sitting there very primly and properly waiting for me to give him the, yeah. So who takes a very intelligent, well-trained dog like this and just drops him off? And he was skinny. He was skinny when he got to us. But anyway, that's how we got Rocky the Rottweiler.
I was pretty impressed with how well-trained Nick was, too. Was that really, you know, that he would stay even?
Absolutely.
Wow.
And, you know, he learned from Rocky because Rocky was the main dog. And when he came, he emulated. That was one thing we always did. We had dogs that were very well-trained. People have always said, you have the most polite dogs. And so if you bring a younger one in when those, you know, those others are getting older and then they just don't even have to do anything more than follow what the other dogs are doing. And Nick was very much like that. And he was very good about any voice inflections, very listened for it, watched for cues, and actually obeyed very well like that, except if he could get it food. And there was nothing you could say at that point that would take him off of the food.
Oh, the scene with the grilled cheese sandwiches being spilled on the floor, that was precious.
Thank you. And he really would eat 5 sandwiches. They were there. If there had been 10, he would eat them.
Wow.
He was a remarkable dog.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Rebecca Warner, author of My Dad, My Dog. Rebecca, would you like to read from the book for us?
Oh, I am so glad you asked me to do that because I haven't had an opportunity to do so yet. Because you asked for 5 to 7 minutes, I took an excerpt that was about that long. And just to tell you where we are in the book, chapter 37, it's Christmas morning, and they're going to be visiting their cousins, Deborah and Charles, in Tennessee, going across the mountain. But Dad's been really unresponsive all morning. So let me start with, they're on the trip, they're going to Deborah's house, and I call Deborah and ask her to put on a pot of coffee, explaining that the trip has put him to sleep and I can't keep him awake. What else am I going to say? That he went practically comatose this morning, but we decided to drag him across the mountains anyway? Just as we're turning into Deborah's driveway, Dad mumbles, "Where are we?" I'm excited to think he has come around, but by the time Deborah, Charles, and their son Brad come out to greet us, Dad's head is dipping in sleepy torpor again. David rolls him down the Vamps ramp onto the driveway. Deborah, Charles, and Brad hail Dad with hearty Merry Christmas greetings, accompanied by hugs, pats, and kisses. But he doesn't so much as move an eyelash. We all contemplate Dad for a moment, and a sense of dismay descends on our group until I say, "Let's get him inside and get some coffee into him." The hint of optimism in my voice must be motivational because everyone starts moving. Deborah assures me in a confident voice that she has a fresh pot at the ready and further assures me it will help. I love my cousin's positivity. She sets off at a brisk pace to get inside the house, no doubt to ready a cup of coffee for the medicinal purposes we've assigned to it. As we all come to a rolling stop inside the foyer, Deborah comes out of the kitchen with a plastic coffee mug with a sippy top. Smart. Having done their duty to get Dad hauled up the outside steps and safely inside, the guys relax, shake hands, and slap each other's backs. They unanimously agree a glass of scotch would hit the spot, and Brad catches David up on football scores as they round the corner, their voices fading away from us. They're leaving the revival to Deborah and me. "What's wrong with him today?" She looks seriously worried, and rightfully so. She extends her arm and holds the sippy mug under his nose, hoping the stimulating aroma will bring him around. There is still no response from Dad, as I confess. I don't know, but he's been like this since this morning after breakfast. It was tough to get him ready. "Do you think he has another UTI?" From taking care of her mother, she knows this kind of lethargy is one of the symptoms. Her mother was able to vocalize the discomfort, whereas dad, like so many patients with dementia, is not. That's what I'm worried about. Deborah sets the cup on the table in the foyer where I remove the neck pillow. We struggle with dad's stiffened limbs to get him out of his heavy jacket, and then I reposition the pillow. The bottom of his face has more or less disappeared into it, and he seems to descend into an even deeper slumber. Deborah gently unfolds his fisted right hand and wraps each finger around the coffee cup. It has a serious tilt to it, and it looks precarious to me, but it's plastic and has the spill-proof top, so it shouldn't cause any damage if it drops. I have to wonder why she put it into his hand when the bottom half of his face, including his mouth, is buried in the neck pillow. I see no coffee drinking action forthcoming, but hey, it's there if he wakes up and decides he wants a sip of revitalizing coffee. We study him for an anxious moment, then Deborah tries the old magic kiss cure. She takes his face in both of her hands and raises his head. She plants a big kiss on the top of his head and says, "Merry Christmas, Uncle Joe." She has used her best and most robust holiday cheer voice. However, when a plausible amount of time has elapsed without a response, not even a crack of the eyelids, she looks at me and says, "Oh boy." Christmas dinner happens around Dad. He's at the head of the table with Deborah and me on either side of him, trying to wake him and encourage him with enticing smells. We go so far as to hold forks and spoons laden with different foods under his nose, using food as an equivalent to smelling salts in hopes of reviving him. At one point, he moans, but we don't know if it's with appreciation or an aggravation, so we abandon our efforts. Charles suggests we sing Christmas carols, reminding us that Dad loves them and loves to sing along with them. We all hail the idea, so he changes out the classical renditions of Christmas carols currently playing and puts on a lively CD of various artists. We all sing along with gusto. I'm particularly good at singing along with Brenda Lee when she's belting out "Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree." No one can put more emphasis on the deck than I can when Brenda gets to the line, "Deck the halls with boughs of holly." I give it my best today in a voice that's been known to startle people to the point of dropping things or jumping a half foot in place. Too bad Christmas only comes around once a year. I direct my song at Dad with real intent. His eyes pop open, but they are bleary and disengaged until they land on Charles. Then they focus and widen, and we all watch with anticipation, thinking this is it. He's coming around. But he only gives Charles an oddly accusatory look and then nods off again. Mild-mannered Charles looks confused and a little injured. "What did I do?" he asks us. Brad's girlfriend, Paula, who arrived a few minutes after we did, shyly suggests, "Maybe the music was too loud?" Charles looks like any wrongfully accused man at a holiday table would look, but he doesn't reply. Just then, in a startling moment that catches us off guard, Dad emits a loud grunt and his eyes pop open. With his head still resting to the side on his pillow, he takes a slow roving inventory of his surroundings. He straightens his head and looks directly at Charles. We all watch as he raises his arm in slow motion. His gaze doesn't falter as he points an unsteady finger at Charles and says in a tone of accusatory mirth, "You're an instigator. You know that." We all burst into laughter, and Dad smiles his devilish smile and states he's hungry. It's like a switch has been turned on, activating his mind and body. He becomes animated and takes pleasure in each and every bite of food Deborah and I offer. As I watch him, I think about how, over the years, we've received invitations to parties with a little maxim which said, "No gifts, please. Your presence is our present." Until now, I always thought that was kind of hokey, even if it was well-intentioned. But it's perfectly applicable to this day of celebration. Dad's presence is the best Christmas present I'll receive this year.
Thank you, Rebecca. That was Rebecca Warner.
That was very good.
Reading from My Dad, My Dog.
Thank you.
Would you explain the difference between just severe dementia and Alzheimer's? Is there some difference there? Or?
Well, Alzheimer's is actually a type of dementia. And there are different kinds of dementia. And Alzheimer's is just one type of dementia. It is the most regularly diagnosed. 70% of dementia cases are diagnosed as Alzheimer's. And Dad, they're very fast progressing Alzheimer's and slow progressing Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, Dad's was a slow progressing type of Alzheimer's. And I made a lot of efforts to learn how to communicate with him, to keep him aware and engaged and able to speak. So in the book, as you read, he doesn't speak as quickly as you're going to be reading him speaking, but he could still speak. In fact, I just published an article in 50 Plus about effective communication techniques for people with dementia. And they seemed to work very well for Dad and I. In fact, we really did communicate until just days before he passed away. And I was very fortunate in that regard because I do know dementia, Alzheimer's patients who very quickly descend into not communicating at all in a short time. And have you ever known anyone with dementia?
Yes, my mother had it.
Oh, what was hers like?
Well, she would, you know, she was in the nursing home, and because I tried to take care of her, but after a while she wouldn't let me bathe her or anything, so it was just too difficult. But she would look at me when I would talk to her, and I could tell that she knew I was someone she should know, but she couldn't, and after a while she wasn't able to talk. She had a series of strokes. So but I knew she knew me, you know, and I can't. And once when our priest went to the nursing home to have Mass, when he spoke to her and took her hand, I could see her face light up. She knew what he was. So I was, you know, but yeah. It's
interesting. Yeah. And it's interesting what they do remember and what they do recognize. Did she have better days than others where you saw that she was more communicative or more aware?
Well, after a while, there wasn't any good days. It was just, you know,
yes,
one thing after another, but and slow digression. But there was a lady there in the nursing home who looked after her. She was another resident, and the doctor had said that my mother should lie down after lunch because she always went to sleep, and he thought it'd be better she was lying down. And so this lady always told the nurse, she said, now Monica's supposed to, her name was Monica, Monica's supposed to lie down after lunch, you know.
Aww.
I know, I know. It was sweet.
That is sweet. Yeah.
And her grandma's memory loss occurred gradually over many, many years. You know, it was obvious long before she was in the nursing home. There were times, I mean, I can remember when she was still living independently and she would be talking about, like, my brother, and she couldn't remember his name, and she'd go, you know, the big one that lives down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, like, wave south, because he lived in Missouri, and things like that. And
but at least she could recall that much.
Yes,
they start losing details like that, like names.
Right.
Yes.
And like you said, it's interesting what, like, they may remember something that is, happened 40 years ago, but not what happened yesterday. And that, you know, you had that, or you described that in your book too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's disconcerting. And this is the thing when you, that I, all that was in the article about, you become the primary communicator with the Alzheimer's person. If you move them into their home, your caretaker and communicator, and just having to adjust to the changes that happen over time. Something like would happen with Dad. He would be looking at a plate, but he would call it a skillet. So they lose words and they lose their ability to use words. And so that's something you just have to adjust to and go along with. I think it's important when people misremember things, those with dementia, that people not try to correct them or try to remind them or try to change their minds. Have you ever seen that kind of behavior where people do that with people who don't have their memory, and it just frustrates them more?
Right. I can't remember things either sometimes. I mean, people's names.
I know. I should be the one writing about this, right? When I'm always looking for something I put down somewhere, or that's been going on for years and years, and
I know, and those of us as we get older, we all have some memory lapses. I think we call them senior moments, and but there is the fear, particularly if you had an older relative, a parent, grandparent. And in my case, with my grandmother, almost all of her 8 siblings also had dementia. And so there's some fear that it's going to happen to us. And so every little lapse, we're like, is that it? Is it happening?
Is that it? Have I turned that corner? Yes, it's absolutely true. And, one thing that I have a friend, and I did an awful lot of research over the years on Alzheimer's, but one simple little test is you may see someone you know and you've known them for a while, but you just can't recall their name, not at that moment. That's fine. That's normal. It's when you don't recognize that person as someone you've known that you've turned the corner.
Oh, that is good to know.
Well, it kind of keeps me grounded. Yeah. Takes away some of my worry. I've always been bad with names, so.
Right. And I have told Mom a number of times when she's like, forgets something and she gets a little concerned. I go, Mom, I'm forgetting as much as you are, so I think you're doing all right. I think you're pretty good here.
You sound really good, Caroline, actually. I don't think you have any problems right now. But I understand
the fear. I've been fortunate that I never forget a face. names escape me, but I've always been able to, you know, if I see someone that I knew long ago, I say, I know who you are.
Now that, to me, is a remarkable talent. You should have been a politician. No, you're too nice to be a politician.
Well, I have a friend who doesn't recognize people that she knows. I mean, and she's a younger person. It's just, she never has been able, that's been that way all her life. And so it's very disconcerting.
Yeah, but, I bet it is.
Yeah. She manages to, to deal with it. But when she told me that, I thought, oh gosh, that's really sad.
But you have to wonder how someone's mind, what part of it's affected that's so. So we know that because we've always recognized faces, once that happens that we don't, then something has developed. But that's interesting that with her, she has trouble recognizing faces of people she really already knows.
So, Rebecca, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. I noticed that your books that you've written are all very different. So you have a political thriller, you have a romance, and you have kind of a self-help relationship advice book. And now you have this very sweet book about caring for an elderly parent.
Family fiction, yes.
Yeah. So, why did you start writing, and what keeps you writing in all these different genres?
I just feel like I have the luxury of writing in different genres. And these are, every book that I've written is a book that I felt needed to be written. Moral infidelity. I'm a feminist. I'm going to say it right now. I do believe in choice. And it's about an anti-abortion governor whose mistress becomes pregnant and the choices he's forced to make when an unintended pregnancy threatens to blow up his life. And it all had to do with what was happening with legislation, more and more restrictive legislation happening within states, Supreme Court ruling that allowed states to start tightening up. And I just felt compelled to write that book. And It turned out to be a pretty good thriller, and I enjoyed doing that genre, and people wanted me to write a sequel to it. And I just didn't feel, I felt like I told the story and there was no sequel to be had. So I moved into the next thing, which is about a very independent woman who just doesn't understand why it has to come down to just choosing one man when there are so many wonderful men out there. And she lives her life on not looking for happily ever after, but on her terms. And as a single woman in Miami for many years by choice, I just lived a very independent life, as did many of my girlfriends. I mean, we burst onto the scene out of college, 70s and 80s. And so the world was wide open to us, and there were no barriers. You could go anywhere you wanted in business or your career or whatever you were doing. You could make your own money, live your own good lifestyle, date as many men as you wanted at one time, just like a man would do with a woman, with women, and not apologize for it. And so it was just portraying, actually, the character in that was a conglomerate of a number of fabulous women I knew in Miami in our single days. And then I always felt for the third book, Self-Help, women have come to me all for many years and asked my advice. And I used to, all these problems they were having with men, and I just didn't understand it. I will tell you, I had 9 proposals of marriage, my husband being the 9th. And I thought men were pretty easy to figure out. And I used to say, well, what's the problem? He's just a man. And so I had to name that book, He's Just a Man, because I said it so often. And I feel like I really helped a lot of women over the years. If they listened to what I had to say and took my advice, they asked for advice. I will say I got a number of women to the altar, and that is the truth.
Whoa.
Yes. So, see, I have all these different experiences in life. We live all these years, and all these things happen, and I was fortunate enough just to be able to write exactly what I wanted to. And then when caregiving became such a big issue to me, and the privilege and loving experience I had taking care of my dad, and I took care of my mother just as well for years, that was the next thing I wanted to write about. And so I have a number of author friends who are very successful, very talented. They always write in the same genre, and we can count on them to deliver a fabulous book every year. But that's just not the direction I went in. And success is in your own estimation, I guess. Sure. If you're making a lot of money, that's one measure of success. But I also feel like, hey, I got to write about what I wanted to write about, and it's gotten published, and it's hopefully going to help people and do well.
Did you have any trouble finding a publisher for any of your books?
I self-published my first 3 books. My husband's an attorney. We set up a publishing company, and I just didn't want to go through that process. I just thought, oh, great, people are self-publishing now. This is what I'm going to do. And in fact, Moral Infidelity, I just threw out there. I had no idea what I was doing, did not have a social media presence, had not built up a community of readers, nothing. And it still did very well. Got really incredible reviews, a number of really great reviews, won some awards. So I said, okay, maybe I can do this. I have some writing chops. Just go ahead and do the next. But this one, it was interesting because I was shopping it to agents. I was querying, and several of them said the same thing, basically the same thing. It's a good story. It's beautifully written, et cetera. I don't think I can sell this. I don't think there's a market for this book. And so I then was reading a book called The 5 Wishes of Mr. Murray McBride. And it's just, oh, if you want to read a fabulous book, please. It is incredible. And I thought this book is a lot like My Dad, My Dog, just in its tone, its humor, its tenor. And so I thought, who published this? And I looked, and I found Black Rose Writing had published it, and I looked them up. and they seem to have a pretty nice stable of authors, successful authors, and I could submit directly to them. So I submitted directly, queried them, and sent them the first whatever pages. They asked for the rest of the manuscript. And then several weeks later, they came back and said, "We want to publish this book." So the first publisher I submitted to wanted it.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank
I would
you.
say so.
But I think the reason that you found that success, besides the fact that it is actually a very well-written book and a good story
Thank
and
you.
very timely, is that you looked and found a publisher that publishes the type of book that you wrote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was like a little awakening, just like, this has the same, wonder who published this book. And there it was. It was just one of those things, good things that happen to you, you know?
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And are you working on another book now?
I am working on another book. In fact, I finished another book, but I'm not sure I'm going to publish it.
Why is that?
This is a very difficult business. But no, I do enjoy writing more than the publishing part of it. But it's a fun book too. It's a chick flick book, I would say, this time around. It's called Ballet Bars, Barres, actually based on a real character. And it's about a group of women who took ballet lessons together for 20 years from Madame Sophie, and she was beloved to them. And they come together years later to save her from this dastardly, menacing relative who has taken over her life and is keeping her a virtual prisoner in her own home. And her life is becoming imperiled through neglect. And when the ballerinas discover the situation, they come together from all points. They all come back together to save her. And there's a lot of shared memories, humor, life lessons, stories, and these women who get the job done in banishing him in the most satisfying way you can imagine from Madame Sophie's life.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, if you ask me.
It is a fun book. There's a lot of humor in that one.
But we are out of time.
Oh,
And
thank
so
my
we
goodness,
are,
that was so quickly.
I
Thank
know
you.
we're going to have to wrap up. Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yes, I do. This is actually on the cover of the book. This is a quote from Mother Teresa. It's not how much you do, but how much love you put into the doing.
Oh, and that's a perfect way to sum up this book and this
It
conversation.
is. Thank you. It's been
Thank
lovely.
you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.